On today's College Football Inquirer, Darian Mensa might be the most controversial quarterback in America now that Brennan Sorsby is not playing. Did he leave Duke for Miami for money? Did he do it for a championship? Did he do it to improve his draft stock? We will discuss. Plus, Ross Dellinger has a congressional minute. Things are hopping on Capitol Hill with the Protect College Sports Act. And Bill Belichick moving into year two at North Carolina. Is it going to get better? We'll discuss on today's College Football Inquirer. This is the College Football Inquirer with Stephen Godfrey and Ross Dellinger. I am Andy Staples, and we are talking controversial quarterbacks. It's not Brennan Sorsby. We're not talking about Brennan Sorsby anymore. He's not playing. We're moving on to the next most controversial quarterback, and Ross Dellinger had an incredible story from ACC Media Days about new Miami quarterback Darian Mensa, who is former Duke quarterback Darian Mensa, who is former Tulane quarterback Darian Mensa, but the former Duke quarterback of it does the heavy lifting because we found out Darian Mensa was leaving Duke pretty much the last day of the transfer portal window, and then Duke sued him, and then Miami presumably paid a buyout. This is the highest paid player in the country. It's also the guy who leads the team that is supposed to win the ACC. Ross, you talked to Darian, you talked to his mom. What'd they tell you?
Yeah, well, it was interesting to see Darian at the same event that a year ago he was dressed in his Duke suit, and to see him dressed in his Miami suit a year later, parading sort of through the Hilton in downtown Charlotte was interesting, right? It was probably a good snapshot of like this era of college sports. So yeah, we sat down for a little bit and talked about the process of him leaving, why he left, kind of how he left, and then his mom Naomi, who has moved to Miami with him, along with all his brothers and sisters too. The whole family is now down in
Miami. Was Mominger her word that she gave you for
Mominger? No, that was his. He said okay. Mominger because she's basically his manager. So yeah, she's his manager. His older brother is his like social media sort of advisor, graphic advisor or whatever. And then his sister is like, books a lot of his stuff, like NIL stuff, whatever. And so he's got this whole team of like family sort of, management staff. And yeah, mom is the mominger. One of the interesting things she told me is that, you know, they left their agency, which was interesting. So that he doesn't have an agent now, and the mom is there acting as his agent.
Mom take? So,
I don't know. Well, mom got a new house. He bought her a house in Kendall, South Miami, and so that's where all the brothers and sisters and her are now living. The conversation with her is fascinating. Conversations with her are always fascinating. And one of the things she revealed is that they had 6 hours on the final day of the transfer portal to decide whether they were going to get in the transfer portal and then obviously go to Miami, or if they were deciding to stay at Duke. And they obviously decided to get into the transfer portal. And she documented with me all the issues that obviously they faced in leaving the school from Duke fans and the like. And, you know, she had to get off of social media, and she and the family had sort of threatening messages and all that stuff. You know, the typical things that you might find. So it was a fascinating conversation. Bueller.
So, well, it was interesting hearing them discuss the reasons.
Yeah.
6 hour thing I find fascinating too, because that feels like a decision that you should have already had made. Obviously Miami was casting about, and also it does give you a window into Miami's desperation to get a quarterback at that late hour. Cause I remember being at the ACC spring meetings and talking to people and finding out that Miami had kicked the tires on like the Darian Mensa going to Miami was them coming back to him. But they had kicked the tires on Jaron Kiave-Sagapoletelli at Cal, Mason Heinschel at Pitt. Like they'd looked around at some other quarterbacks in the league and outside the league. Damon Williams, who was going to enter the portal at Washington. Allegedly, Miami was involved in that particular decision that never came to be. So
it's good. No, it's good that you're saying Miami too. It takes a little heat off LSU, you know.
Well, right, because I think that's. I don't think people understand that Miami was the more desperate of the actors.
Yes.
In the portal cycle, LSU, they took. Yeah, they Sam Leavitt. They gave him a huge deal. Lane Kiffin obviously kind of followed him to his official visit to Tennessee.
And Leavitt visited Miami, right?
He did. He did.
Yeah.
And but LSU was also taking Hassan Longstreet from USC. They were not as desperate. Lane's like, I can always make a quarterback work.
Yeah, he was going to shop around. Yeah, yeah,
yeah. Miami wanted an established starting quarterback who they thought would be really good. Now, I would argue they landed maybe the best possible option here. And this is where the other piece of your story comes in, Ross, to me, because they were discussing the reasons for leaving Duke for Miami. And if you're a Duke fan, I don't blame you for being mad at all. But their reasons probably are semi-valid. Like, when they're talking about, we want him to be the number one pick in the NFL draft. Well, what happened when Cam Ward went from Washington State to Miami? He became the number one pick in the NFL draft. Carson Beck, I don't know if he improved his draft stock or not, but he was coming off a pretty horrific injury.
Yeah.
He did take him to the national title game and had the best showcase possible for himself. I don't know that he helped himself, but he had the showcase for it. Shannon Dawson is a very good play caller. He's a guy that I think a lot of quarterbacks would want to work with. And
yeah,
so I get that part of it. And I got to be honest with you. I look around across the country. I think they have as good a chance at anybody as at ending up in the national title game again.
Yeah, it's the talent around them, right? Like, I think they looked at sort of what the talent would look like around them. The quote from his mom was, "We could go back to Duke and just win the ACC again, maybe, but would we be able to win a national championship? And would he be able to win the Heisman Trophy?" And I mean, she didn't say no, but the obvious sort of answer is they thought no. That at Duke, you couldn't do those things. And at Miami, it's been shown that you can. And one of the things, I've left it out of my story, but like Cam Ward, like Darian was a big Cam Ward fan, watched Cam Ward video, even back at Duke, even back at like Tulane, like studied Cam Ward, was a big fan of him. And I think he watched him play at Miami into that system and wanted to, sort of wanted to be that guy. Now, let's be real. He's not leaving without more money. Yeah, he's not leaving for a pay cut. Like none of us and none of the coaches leave for a pay cut. Like I'm sure that didn't happen. I'm sure he got paid pretty well.
Andy, you asked three questions on the little promo thing that we shoot for each show before we went in. Did he leave for money? Right. Did he leave to improve his draft stock? Did he leave to win a championship? It really doesn't matter. The answer should be yes to all three. And then the ratio of decision-making doesn't really matter. This is now the established path for quarterbacks who want to have as prolific and popular a career as possible. So, yeah, we're going to see a lot more of this. And it's funny because we talked about Miami's kind of philosophy change in personnel a couple shows ago. The desperation in grabbing Mensa and paying market rate, at least, right, if not above, it might be one of the reasons we're seeing them diversify a little bit and ironically dump more money into the quarterback position, but maybe prevent themselves from being up against a wall where you are paying 90% of the bill for a national title contender. But if you have a quarterback, it doesn't really matter, which is one of the reasons they were so stressed in going after and willing to pay for Mensa, because think about all the commitments they have across that roster.
Yeah, because they've done a really good job developing offensive linemen that they recruited out of high school. They've done a good job on the defensive line. They went out and fixed their secondary last year in the transfer portal. They have one of the best receivers in the country in Malachi Toney. And I think that's an interesting part, too, because remember, Darian Mensa was not the only player who left Duke that day to go to Miami. His best receiver, Cooper Barkate, went with him. And for those who don't know who Cooper Barkate is, he was the best receiver in the Ivy League at Harvard. in 2024. He graduates from Harvard. He hops in the portal, goes to Duke, and has 1,100 receiving yards at Duke last year. Well, now he goes to Miami. So this is a guy who's already had 1,100 receiving yards in the ACC. He goes to Miami. He will never have to play against a team's best corner.
Harvard
because
to
that guy's going to be covering Malachi Toney.
Harvard to Miami. How can you not love this sport right now? This is fantastic. Andy,
it's
you
incredible.
You were at the ACC media event days, whatever they call these damn things now. Was Miami, like Miami's pole position in terms of narrative and expectation in this league right now? We have other contenders. We broke all that down. Is there any talk about, there's still this like, I feel like the playoff erased a lot to talk a little football for a second, which is that this is still a Miami team that doesn't win all the games Miami is supposed to just win. Right. Like this is still a September Miami and an October Miami. We saw that playoff run. I really think it started the second against what A&M, I think, where it was just, okay, we've switched gears here. We're going to justify our inclusion.
It actually happened for them against NC State last year when they had four guys hurt. They're sitting on two ACC losses. NC State has started to wake up and become a better team.
Yeah.
And Miami just absolutely drills them. And they're playing a couple freshmen that they hadn't planned to play. And that's where it felt like it all woke up. But we talked about this on my On Three show this week. Can Miami win from the front? Because
yeah, that's a good way to say it.
The Miami of the 21st century has never been able to do that. There's a reason they've never won the ACC.
No, you're just going to make your layups.
21 years, right.
Yeah, pick your sports metaphor.
And I noticed, like, after that discussion on social media, people are like, well, no, they never can. They'll never do it. And then, obviously, the Georgia fan chimes in with, well, when you get, like, a second or third chance, it's fine. I'm like, well, you could also beat Ole Miss in the playoff like they did. My On Three co-host, Ario Wasserman, made a really good point. He said, making your layups, winning from the front, however you want to describe it, is the final stage in competitive evolution.
Yes.
Like that's what everybody's really trying to get to. And
yes,
that's where Miami's at right now.
2007 Alabama is losing at home to a Sun Belt team. 2009 Alabama is a war machine from hell that is just treating every single non-conference and lower tier SEC game like it is the national championship, famously under Saban. And so while that's not the only blueprint available, Miami has been hilariously inconsistent in its brand. I mean, look, it wasn't a few years ago that Mario Cristobal's in-game decision-making cost them a loss.
They didn't take a knee against Georgia Tech and lost.
Yeah, against Georgia Tech. Yeah. Like we're not that far removed from kind of a comedy of errors. And yet, to prove that I don't even listen to the words that I say, I'm sitting here looking at their schedule, gentlemen. And I'm thinking, no, they're fine. They're manageable. Fine. They're fine. Yeah, I'm going through at Clemson.
They will
October
be favored
2nd.
In at least 11 games. The only one they probably won't be favored in is at Notre Dame.
Honestly,
if Notre Dame loses at BYU, that could be different too. So
that game is November 7th. If you're talking about Miami relative to playoff level competition, they are playing Notre Dame on November 7th. Until then, yes, you have the traditional rivalry. You have Florida State, but that's at home. And yes, you are on the road at Clemson. But you are, at least according to like the financial metrics, a significantly better team than those two. You should be, we can preview the Irish later. Miami should be undefeated according to the money they've spent, the moves they've made, and the things that they've postured publicly on November 7th. They should be undefeated.
And they're playing with a little motivation. I hate to use the like they're hungry cliche, but like talking to the players in Cristobal at ACC media days, man, the whole like national championship game loss, the pissed off is a word that was used by pretty much everybody, including Cristobal, multiple times. So they haven't forgotten the loss to Indiana and the fact that they played the first half without their starting cornerback.
I would trust Miami tremendously when Mario Cristobal is coaching with emotion and he has the ability to manipulate emotion, like negative emotion, like we're angry, we're disrespected.
Yeah, right.
The aforementioned gaffes and blunders have been when things are flat or things are taken for granted. So if Miami's pissed off out of the gate, We'll get a little white smoke, little 1980s, call Uncle Luke, like that kind of Miami.
Well, and if you look at Mario Cristobal's motivational tactics throughout the last year or so, he's had to try to manufacture that chip on the shoulder, pissed off. Yep. And he'll have to work really hard to do that. Because, like, they open Friday, on a Friday.
At Stanford.
Like, they're going to have to play some goes sleepy home. Games. Yeah. And the book on Miami is not, it's not like the James Franklin era Penn State. Oh, they don't win the big games. They're up for the big games. They don't get up for the sleepy games. Well, on the farm on a Friday night, sleepy. It's going to be sleepy.
It's pretty sleepy. I mean, I guess it makes a little difference that it's like the first game, but you'd think you'd be ready for like the opener, but yeah. And Darian's from just like not too far down the road either. So he talked about
He's
that a little
San
bit
Luis Obispo,
media days.
One of the prettiest cities in the world. It's an amazing place. Shout out to Jake Dickert again. Andy and I are, I think we're getting a percentage cut now on that contract. So holler at your boy. Yeah. Well, I don't know. My lawyer hasn't received any contact yet. You want to talk about sleepy? Andy, Friday night, September 18th in Winston-Salem at 6:30 when no one will be watching.
That is not going to be sleep. That won't be sleepy in the stadium because one, our man Jake Dickert has the Wake Forest people pumped. You know, this is a program that won 9 games last year.
Yeah.
Like, that's going to be a sellout crowd.
But,
and honestly, Friday night, those, and Jim Phillips talked about this yesterday at the ACC kickoff event.
Yeah.
They're intentionally putting these games on Friday night. Well, but they want you to see their teams.
Ross, you were in Charlottesville when they rushed the field last year. That was a Friday night.
Right? Yeah.
Or a Thursday night. Like, yeah. those games are
Yeah,
great.
It was Friday, I think. Yeah.
I've given up on my whole thing that we shouldn't play college football on Friday nights. It is what it is. I go back to that Miami perspective, Andy, which is that they seem to get sort of demotivated, colorblind, whatever you want to call it. Just sort of like the fight goes out of them when you're in the cul-de-sac of ACC teams that are all like, pick one of the tobacco teams, maybe like maybe it's Pitt this year, whatever, like the noisy out 7 or 8 win teams. And that's where Miami trips.
Yeah, it's okay. So last year, now SMU obviously was very good, but Louisville comes to Miami on a Friday night, and Louisville just flat out beat them. Like there was nothing fluky about that. Louisville just flat out beat them.
A lot of turnovers in that game. Carson Beck's probably worst game of the season.
Correct. We talked about the Georgia Tech one where they didn't kneel a couple of years ago. The Virginia Tech game on a Friday night in Miami where they had to. There was a very controversial reviewed play where it might have been a Hail Mary touchdown that would have beaten
them. Yeah, that was a Friday night game. Yeah. That was one of Brent Pry's best wins. Yeah. The jump ball in the end zone.
Some people think he did.
Yeah, exactly.
No, so, I was being mean. Sorry.
Yeah, that's going to be the challenge for them is can they overcome that? And if they can, then we're talking about a team that definitely is a legitimate national title contender. This team, if we're being real, and I know Rhett Lashley will get mad at me for saying this, but this team, if we're real, being real, should win the ACC. They should not have a problem winning the ACC.
Yes.
Will they have a problem winning it? They might. Like SMU could be a problem if they were to face in the ACC championship game. We don't know what Clemson's going to be. We don't know they're up, down. Florida State, I'm not highly confident in that they're going to be a lot better. So we're going to talk about North Carolina later in the show. Like this is as good of or as easy of a draw as Miami could have gotten because they're not playing SMU this year in the regular season. They've got Notre Dame, but that maybe doesn't hurt them if they lose it.
So Andy, really what we're talking about is the same context as we did last week with Texas Tech and the Big 12. You've spent your way past your middle conference competition. Sure. You stay in the headlines for your NIL machinations more or less. Miami's case, you played in a national title. Texas Tech was in the playoff. And you on all of our metrics on paper, should be significantly better. Maybe marginally better than SMU. I don't know. I feel like the gap between Texas Tech and...
Can I bring it back to Darian Mensah?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah, Texas Tech doesn't have Darian Mensah.
Miami lost a lot of talent. CeCe Mauinoa, first-round offensive tackle. Ruben Bain, first-round edge rusher. Akeem Esidore, first-round edge rusher. Those are massive losses. But they've recruited well. They've developed well at those positions. I think they upgraded at quarterback. I don't know that he's going to be as good as Cam Ward, but I think Darian Mintz is going to be better than Carson Beck. And well, I think that changes how you call plays. That changes strategy. There's a lot to it.
Didn't we say this on one of the umpteen preview shows going into the title game that if this is Cam Ward and last year's Miami, that we're looking at like a 17-point hurricane win against anybody in the national title game? Like, if Cam Ward had been the quarterback, what I'm saying is if you're critical of Miami's roster construction or you're trying to poke holes, Carson Beck was probably the most lacking in key positions last year. If Cam Ward had been there, that's a national championship team with ease.
Right, and if Darian Mensah had been there, that might be a
right.
National championship
that's what I'm, so that's what yeah. I'm getting at. Yeah. I don't know. Edge rushing is hard, like that. Those that's hard to come back from immediately. But they
Damon
are still
Wilson
more talented.
Was the most expensive edge rusher in the portal. Guess where he plays now? Miami.
I mean, it's hard to poke holes.
It's going to be fascinating to watch. But the Mensah thing, and I do think Mensah is going to be probably painted as the villain for a lot of the season. They do play Duke late in the season, by the way. Duke goes to Miami in November. So I think he'll be painted as the villain, and that's fine. Like, he seems like the type that can handle that.
Hang on. If you're Duke, no. You stole that kid from Tulane.
Oh, no. Duke.
Like, Let's stop. Manny Diaz,
I've talked to Manny Diaz about this. He's come on my show and said this. Like, Manny Diaz is never going to criticize Darian Mensah for leaving.
That's ridiculous.
Like, Manny Diaz says, the portal has given more to Duke than has taken away.
Manny was at Temple for how long?
Like a month?
35
minutes. Maybe not even a month,
35 minutes.
I mean, so he does get it. Like, he's realistic about it. I think what made them pretty, like, upset is that he broke a contract without paying the buyout. They had to sue him to get the buyout.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
That's kind of the issue. Yeah.
And nobody's and they got pay it in the buyout end, right? People start paying the buyouts.
Yeah.
So
right. Right. So.
Well, something that could change how all this works, if it ever passes, the Protect College Sports Act. There is some moving and shaking going on in Capitol Hill. Ross will be back with his congressional minute when we return. We are back with College Football Inquirer. It's been a minute since we've talked about what's going on in Capitol Hill. But there is action with the Protect College Sports Act as senators attempt to reconcile the bill with the demands of the SEC and the Big Ten, who currently are against it. They would like them to be for it. They think they have a chance to pass it if they could get the two biggest conferences on board. So a lot has happened in the last week or so. And with that, I'm going to cede the floor to Ross Dellinger for his congressional minute. Hold on. I've got the clock ready. Ross.
Yes.
It is time. All right. Take a deep breath. Here we go. 3, 2, 1.
This week on Capitol Hill has been a busy one, Andy. 4 Big Ten University presidents from Penn State, Michigan, Ohio State, and USC visited with lawmakers. So did Big 12 Commissioner Brett Yormark. On Tuesday, a key call was held between senators and commissioners of the SEC and Big Ten to discuss the latest potential revisions to the bill, all in an effort to gain their support. Then, later Tuesday, senators held another call, a full call with more than 24 conference commissioners to update them on the situation. They described the SEC and Big Ten call as productive, and they expressed optimism in, get this, that the bill could reach the Senate floor next week. Yes, next week is what Ted Cruz told them. It's very optimistic. It does feel more obvious, though, than ever that lawmakers know they really need the support of the two biggest stakeholders for the legislation to pass, not just through the Senate, but maybe through the entire Congress as well. One person described the senators in their staff this week as being in, quote, deal mode, as in they are working around the clock to make a deal with the two leagues. As of Thursday morning, the SEC and Big Ten officials were still waiting on more formalized changes in a new revised bill. Stay tuned.
That's pretty good.
That was close.
Right.
Because you didn't need to stay tuned. Stay tuned. Was extraneous. So I think you got it.
Stay tuned. That's all beautiful. Right. Very good. Very good.
I know there are a laundry list of things the SEC and the Big Ten want them to change about this bill. I'm gonna ask you about two specific ones, though. The first one that felt like a non-starter to me, or actually, if the bill was actually close to passing in the form it started in, would have just caused immediate realignment rather than no realignment, but the blocking realignment, the original text of the bill said the SEC and Big Ten couldn't add any schools if this bill passed. Then they amended it to say the SEC, Big Ten, ACC, and Big 12 couldn't add any schools if this thing passed. Is it now going to go, they can all add schools if this thing passes?
You know, that's a good question. That is something that I don't think they finalized yet on exactly what that language will say, but I know they're going to change it in some way to give schools the ability to move up. And so they're gonna adjust that language in some way, whether they're going to delete, just get rid of the whole language, or they're going to adjust it in some way. I think it's coming. I just don't know exactly what it's going to say, but it's not going to freeze. Like, there won't be a complete freeze as the bill is currently written. And part of that is, I mean, they need votes. And I think we talked about it on the show a couple of weeks ago. Like, Group of Six schools reached out to their senators like, hey, we can't move up if this bill passes. So I think that they would have lost votes that they probably were counting on if this anti-expansion clause would have remained the same.
So what is this bill?
If the anti-expansion clause had been in there and it had passed, if I were the SEC and the Big Ten, I would have just immediately taken the schools I wanted before the law went into effect.
And that's what may have happened, right? Is like you had this like expedited realignment. And so I don't imagine that the bill will read like it did. I think that section will be changed, if not deleted altogether. But I think they're still working toward that. Now, by the time you listen to this on Thursday afternoon, evening, or Friday, the SEC and Big Ten may have already gotten formalized language and will know exactly what it says. But right now, I'm not completely sure, but it will be changed.
So what is left of this bill once it passes the deal-making stage, in terms of the spirit of how it began versus what is actually going to survive when it's been stripped down and the teeth sanded off and so going through the compromise process?
Well, I guess we don't really know, right? Because it feels like we're only at the start of the real compromise process. You know, the lawmakers, I think, had been sort of pushing back on making any change or very little changes to it. They really didn't want to make any changes at all. And they've obviously had to tweak some things. And I think what's happened in the last like 3 weeks is right around the time that it passed the committee and the markup, there was a sense that they had not just 60 votes in the Senate, that they may have had even 70. I don't necessarily think that's the case anymore. And so, and a big reason is the SEC and Big Ten lobbying against it, right? And, and having their senators and their schools lobby against it.
They had to know when they finished writing the original text of the bill that the SEC and Big Ten would be against it. Like, they had to know that.
You know, the original, like, right when it came out, certainly they knew it very soon after, right, it came out. And so they've been knowing it for a while. And look, I think there was a lot of confidence from the lawmakers and their staff that it would at least still pass the Senate without them. And I don't think that's the case anymore. So one of the things in my On Three column that really hasn't been written about, and I had to learn what this is, I'm learning a lot these days, is they tried to do a hotline on the bill about 3 weeks ago where it's an expedited process where you don't have the full floor vote. You just send an email to all the Republicans. And if anybody comes back with an objection, even one person, then it fails, right? You have to have a unanimous consent to it. Well, multiple Republicans objected to it, is what I was told 3 weeks ago, which is sort of a sign of, we might not completely have the 60 or 70 or even 80 that we thought we were. And that's led them to this week, I think, of, all right, we have to change some things in this bill to appease not just the SEC and Big Ten, but all the other leagues, especially around this expansion provision. Well, so, get back to Godfrey's question, though, like of things that, you know, how it will be stripped down. I mean, you will have some changes to the expansion provision. Maybe you will have it completely eliminated. You will have a more assurance that the pooling of rights is voluntary because the SEC and Big Ten are against that.
Which cracks me up because could not be any more clear that it's voluntary.
It seems optional to me when you read it, but they want more concrete language that they won't have to be forced into pooling all their rights. So there's that change. There's some changes around. I think they're going to add some stuff about NIL transparency. If, I can't remember if we talked about that last week, but like creating an NIL database where you know how every school is spending and it, you get uploaded and everybody can see.
Hey, look, maybe, that's a positive thing.
It'd be a blind database.
Yeah. Andy, that's a positive thing. A positive thing might come from this.
It would be a smart thing to do.
Yeah.
They've all run to their state legislatures to try to hide those numbers, and then they realize they played themselves for suckers because it's just raising their prices.
They have to get the antitrust protection on that, right, because of probably some privacy stuff or whatever. And even if it's anonymized, I think they need some kind of legal protection so they don't get sued over doing that. So they're hoping that gets Darian written Mensa in the bill.
If we just see the numbers.
We
don't have... We can figure it out.
Yeah.
The other one I want to talk about is, I know the SEC and the Big Ten would like that language changed where basically players still have the ability to legally challenge all this stuff.
Yeah.
And what they wanted initially was blanket antitrust protection, stuff the railroads didn't even get, which was never going to happen. But is there any chance that, because I would imagine that that's something the Democrats would all push back against.
Yeah. So, you know, the SEC Big Ten sent 10 suggested changes to the legislation. And I think what's being talked about this week are probably half of those, probably around 5-6 potential changes. One of them that I haven't really heard talked about a lot is the one you mentioned. It's a pretty big one where the whole basis of the legislation is getting antitrust protection to enforce the one-time transfer and the five-year eligibility and preempting all these state laws that are workarounds to all that. And so basically, to boil it down for the regular listener, athletes, the way the bill is written, the SEC and Big Ten believe athletes can still sue for various things. So it would minimize the antitrust protection.
I have not heard that being revised. I would look at that and say, this doesn't change anything.
Yeah, this is where I'm heading, a lot of people keep sanding this thing down. I'm just curious. I obviously think that this is an exercise in futility anyway, because it involves the United States government. But if I'm going to take it on its merits, it seems like we've entered the process where we essentially just sort of whittle this thing into nothing or nothing substantial.
But the thing is, the revisions they want, Godfrey, especially to the antitrust stuff, would be to make it stronger. It would be the opposite of sanding it down, right? It would be making
But the problem is much they're going stronger. To run into massive
They are. The Democratic side. And that's why Maria Cantwell, one of the co-authors,
I'm talking about the ultimate result.
Some of that.
Listen, at the end of the day, I think we may end up teaching a lot of college football fans how a bill becomes law.
How the sausage is made. Yes. The thing is like, and this is probably why Ted Cruz told the commissioners that next week it could go to the floor as soon as next week. That is incredibly optimistic. But there is a window, apparently, from what I'm told.
SEC Media Days, baby.
Oh, I know, right in the middle of SEC Media Days. There's a window on the calendar. It just, the way it kind of lined up, there's sort of this window where they have floor time available, which is very precious. And so that's why you're seeing kind of an expedited deal mode effort this week to try to get the SEC and Big Ten on board by making these revisions, because there is floor time next week, next Wednesday, Thursday, apparently. So we'll see if they can get
Thursday.
Yeah. Yeah, they can't. Yes.
What are we doing?
And I don't want to be flying from Tampa back up to DC early necessarily to go sit in on the Senate floor, but that may be what happens. But it's only going to happen next week, probably. I'm just kind of guessing here that the only way the legislation's getting to the floor next week is probably enough revisions are made this week that get the SEC and Big Ten to support.
Yeah, they have to feel like there's a very strong chance of passage, which I would not feel very comfortable with.
And not only that, Andy, but Big Ten like against. If you're the Senate Majority Leader John Thune, you don't only want to make sure that it's going to pass the Senate. You're going to want to make sure it's going to pass the Senate by a significant degree, not just 60 or 61, maybe 67 or 68 or 70, because you want to have a good chance that when it gets to the House, it'll pass the House, or it'll take it seriously.
Out of the formula. So,
Yeah.
Okay.
Until Monday.
Yeah.
So anyway, well, that's John Thune's got to worry about where the jackrabbits, we'll see.
Too. You know, she's South Dakota.
Yeah,
there.
That's right. That's right.
You got to worry about the jackrabbits. Yeah. So that's been Schoolhouse Rock for this week. I'm just a bill.
A bill on Capitol Hill.
That's right.
It won't die. Come back, go away.
Let's talk about another bill. Bill Belichick, starting year two at North Carolina with very little fanfare.
What a segue.
We'll be right back.
From one bill to the other.
We are back, College Football Inquirer. And of course, ACC Media Day is going on right now. Ross was there for day one yesterday. They continue on Thursday and Friday. We'll get to the tiebreaker in a minute because I actually did figure out how the tiebreaker works with some help from Michael Strickland of the ACC, the vice president for football. But I want to talk about Bill Belichick a little bit, guys, because this time last year, we were still in the mode of, oh my God, Bill Belichick is coaching college football. It was insane. And look, yeah. Obviously, his girlfriend became a huge story. All of that became a huge story. But now it feels like we don't talk about it at all because they were so bad last year. And for those of us who do follow the sport year-round, who do follow the roster construction year-round, there is very little optimism for them being any better despite them having a harder schedule. And so it feels like a year later, it's not, oh my God, Bill Belichick's coaching college football. It's, yeah, I guess this is going to happen again.
Yeah. If you're an NFL person and you're wondering why Bill Belichick year two hasn't dominated our headline cycle, it's because all of the things that create buzz or interest in college football, North Carolina hasn't participated in. So Andy, we can start with personnel. Oftentimes, yes, as fun as it is to do the Jordan Hudson thing and to do the Belichick thing and the photos on the beach and the nonsense and the nepotism hires of assistant coaches and his family and all that, I think the real, if you're starting with why is North Carolina under Bill Belichick going to be a tremendous seismic failure, I think it starts with Michael Lombardi. What is his official title? Is it general manager? Remember,
he's the general manager.
Yeah. Well, it's the 33rd NFL team. Remember, he told us that we're the 31st.
It was the 15th Sun Belt team last year, and so, I'm not sure they changed their roster construction methods enough to shake that label.
So this is where I want to start with people, because I get this sometimes from NFL people when I go, especially go up to that corner of the United States in the summertime. People are like, oh, what do you think about Belichick? Man, he's going to take over college football. And I was like, let me sit you down and explain. Football players win football games, have since the beginning of time. Never seen a coach throw a pass and win a game from the sidelines. Not how it happens. Nothing significant. And Andy, you can stop me as the On3 representative. Nothing significant enough has occurred in the personnel side, on the personnel side of North Carolina, for any of us to change our prognostication to medium to bad ACC middle of the pack roster. And what that means is,
correct,
when you compare them, take Miami. We just did a segment on Miami, outlier, right? Same as Texas Tech and the Big 12. Let's talk about, SMU and Clemson. And North Carolina's distance to those schools. I would say
there's...
And
you saw it in the Clemson game last year. Clemson was really bad for Clemson.
Yes.
They annihilated North Carolina because they were better at every position than North Carolina.
So what have they done in the offseason by any metric? Transfer, high school recruiting. I know they're better in high school recruiting. Andy, we talked a little bit about
it. They've gotten better at high school recruiting, which is crazy because this is the time when the good programs, for the most part, are changing the way they recruit out of high school to say we're gonna spot recruit high school and we're gonna pay for the can't misses and we're gonna let everybody else wash out and then we'll get them in the portal. They're doing it the other way around, and then their transfer portal philosophy, like you never saw during the transfer portal season a battle between North Carolina and a team that you would talk about in the national title conversation. Like, that's not who they were competing against. And this is like my friend Bruce Feldman at The Athletic had a great story last year about how a coach who was scouting North Carolina because they had to play him said, I found it odd that they were going against American and Sun Belt teams for players.
Yeah.
Because they have money. It's not like they don't have any money. And again, this year, that felt like what was going on. It felt like they were not trying to compete against the Miamis and the Clemsons and the SMUs for players in the portal. But that's who you have to beat.
So this is where we can do the jokes. We can talk about Bobby Petrino, the new OC, if we want. But
right. Which should help. So let's.
OK.
Brief positive.
Yeah.
One, North Carolina got much better defensively as the year went on last year. They were sloppy, disorganized at first. They were a much better defensive team at the end of the year. They learned. I have a feeling they will probably be pretty sound defensively in terms of scheme, in terms of being well coached.
Yeah.
Again, it's the roster. Offensively, Bobby Petrino replaces Freddie Kitchens. Bobby Petrino is an excellent play caller. They will be better run offensively, but again, the roster.
So a simple way of explaining Bill Belichick's success in the NFL, and I read the Halberstam book years ago, obviously read all of the Wickersham, Don Van Not, all the NFL coverage of Belichick, is that he was really, truly renowned for, well, one, having a generational talent at quarterback that people didn't see coming, that provided consistency at the most important position for over a decade. That's the first thing. The second thing was this. He was the guy who saw something, divination, if you will, in the 6th-round pick that no one else did, or the 7th-round pick, or the 5th-round pick. Mm-hmm. And he was famous for when he had full strength, when he had all the control of the Patriots franchise, which was for most of that time, he would trade back all the time, right? We would talk about, oh, man, the Patriots traded back. You know that guy they took in the 4th. In 3 years, we're going to be talking about him. He's probably going to be all pro at his position. Or they would spend money tactically, like a bunch of sawed-off, stubby white guy receivers who have all since launched podcasts in their retirement. Like, that was the New England machine, right? Okay? I'm serious. I don't need to hear from Julian Edelman this often.
Right. Or he gets Randy Moss on a massive discount.
Because
they got Randy Moss
so
for chunks.
My last one,
yeah.
So my last one, Andy, is character concerns, right? Oh, this guy's a character concern. Well, let's send him. He'll either work or he won't in New England. But the core structure of that organization is stronger than any influence from the outside. So it's like the opposite of like the Marvin Lewis Bengals or something. You know, the NFL axiom is always you can't have a locker room cancer. Whereas New England was, we can suss out the cancer and figure out if there's a good football player left. And if not, we're going to kick his ass out because he's on a 1-year proven deal.
He's on a 1-year deal, yeah.
So none of that applies in college football, okay? If you are seen to be going after the same player that two teams in the American are, it is not because of your renowned scouting ability. It is because you are looking in the wrong damn place. College football recruiting and talent analysis is so much more centered on the raw capability. So if you want to put all the skills of a college football player, an incoming freshman, into 4 or 5 buckets, everyone is going to see those raw skills, okay? The staff at Florida is going to see them. The staff at USC is going to see them. The staff at Georgia. You have to fish where other people are fishing. This counterintuitive concept that North Carolina's coaching staff embodied in the NFL does not apply here. Or, but Andy, and they literally the thing, Godfrey, just don't know what they're doing.
Do you know what 5th and 6th round players are? They're NFL players.
Yes. They
probably were the guys that the Florida and USC and Notre Dame staffs identified as having the raw capabilities.
Yes. But look at it this way. If you're listening, just kind of picture this. Think of a funnel. The very top of the funnel is as wide as the container, right? And that's where we are in college football. So if you miss, there's a higher degree of variance that you're going to miss on. When you get down to the NFL, everything is tight. Like Andy's right. A 5th-round player is still an NFL player. A 1st-round player is an NFL player.
270 draft picks?
Yeah, and 130 of them will be relevant in 3 years, roughly.
Yeah, so but in college football, like
thousands.
With North Carolina, the type of players that they are looking at, if we were to boil it into like recruiting class terms, they're looking in the 1,000 to 2,000 range. The variance is so much higher.
Yes. And it, when people ask, why aren't you talking about Bill Belichick anymore? One, I'm always making those jokes. You can trust in me, America. I will get them North Carolina Bill Belichick's jokes off this year. To the chagrin of my co-hosts, we will make fun of Bill Belichick. But to talk about them seriously would be would feel like a disservice to any other team in the ACC or in college football because, Andy, they don't show up. They don't show up doing the things that you're supposed to do to build a championship program in a Power Four conference. Or they have not shown up to date, at least in the personnel side.
Yeah.
So, yeah. But I'm sure Bobby Petrino will fix all that.
But that's why you're not seeing any buzz. That's why people are not excited about it. That's why I was watching the ACC network coverage of ACC Media Days, and they threw out the obligatory Bill Belichick question, and the entire desk was trying to come up with something nice to say.
Mm-hmm.
But couldn't really succeed because unless they really did discover some diamonds in the rough, it's probably going to look a lot like it looked last season because, again, they had the easiest schedule draw you can possibly imagine last year, and they went 4-8.
Yeah, and the teeth of this
it's
thing.
It's harder this year.
Yeah,
like they still open with TCU. This time it's in Ireland, week zero. They've got to play Notre Dame. Like that Notre Dame is the exact opposite of this. Like Notre Dame is paying for the best of the best.
Right, but just
it might be the best roster in college football.
What's the buyout? What's his buyout dropped to?
It's substantial.
$10 million after this year.
But
it was a $30 million fully guaranteed deal, so it's $10 million if you want to.
I'm going to be honest with you. Yeah, there's a hot seat potential there, but I also think there are a tremendous amount of people around North Carolina who are still kind of in the grieving bargaining phase. What are the stages of grief? Denial, bargaining phase on having.
They're the ones who every time I write about Belichick, they write to me and say, you know, he hasn't had time to get his players in.
Mm. Yeah.
And he was hired very late in the process. And then I always point out that our guy, Jake Dicker, at Wake Forest was actually hired after Bill Belichick.
There's enough of
a much better team.
Yeah.
There's enough of that sweater vest contingent, I think, to buy him another year, Ross. But let's just like very simply, Andy, they open against TCU. TCU has a better roster. There is no comparison. Clemson has a better roster. There is no comparison. Notre Dame has a better roster. I just named three of your first four opponents.
They play Miami.
I know. These are just the three of your first four opponents. You do get East Tennessee State at home in a second.
Hopefully you have a better roster than East Tennessee
Shout
State.
Shout out Will Healy and the Buccaneers.
Oh, yeah.
That's right. That's where Healy is now.
So you're 1-3.
And at quarterback, you have Billy Edwards Jr., who was pretty good at Maryland a couple years ago. He goes to Wisconsin, terrible knee injury. First game of the season, non-contact. It sucked. You know, maybe he rounds back and forth. They have Miles O'Neal, the transfer from Texas A&M. So maybe they strike gold there. But here's the other part where it could just look bad. Now, they don't play Wake Forest this year, which is probably lucky for them.
Yeah.
But Gio Lopez, the quarterback they got out of the portal last year, they paid to get him from South Alabama. That was their big investment in the portal.
Yeah, their get.
Gio Lopez goes to Wake Forest where he is reunited with his South Alabama offensive coordinator, Robbie Zell. Watch him be way better than he was at North Carolina.
Mm.
Yeah. Robbie Zell, famous for his Nick Saban impersonation.
Yes.
As I go through here, I feel like 1-3 is very likely. And the back end are all teams who are not remarkable by any stretch, but are all doing the college football part of college football better. So like
this is one of the harder ACC schedules. Like,
yeah,
it's a 17 team league. All ACC schedules are not equal, but this is like you're at Clemson, you're at Pitt, at Duke is not going to be easy. Like Manny Diaz. Mm-hmm. We talked about him losing his quarterback, but he's been very successful.
What's their Vegas over-under with that schedule? It's got to be like four and a half or something.
Four and a half.
Yeah.
This is not me putting salt in the wound. Yeah. They have a road game at Connecticut in November.
Oh, I know. Now taking over. Yeah.
Listen to me.
God dang.
In between games, game is in between, on the road, in stores, in between Miami and Louisville. The wheels could fall completely off of this thing where I don't know, Andy, if the sweater vest contingent can push this along. And Andy, this is where I tie it back to the first segment. And I remind you right now, if you are a North Carolina fan in any stage of denial, you could have right now John Summerall and Darian Mensah. That could be your football team right now. But you chose this guy. You know who else is saying that quietly? Bubba Cunningham.
coasting into retirement, Bubba Cunningham.
Buddy, if he doesn't get I Told You So tattooed across his back the size of a serial killer in Cape Fear, I don't know what he's doing, dog.
This somehow, is the great, I don't think this
Bubba, Buddy doesn't come seem out, like come a out, tattoo guy.
Just, yeah. I want it on the knuckles, homie. Like, this is this is going to be hands down one of the greatest I Told You So moments of a departing leader in that I can think of in modern college history. This will be one of the greatest mishires. If Florida is in the college football playoff by 2028, Andy, this is
Island, from your lips to God's ears, God, for hearing that.
Yeah, but I mean, like, could you imagine what if John Summerall turns out to be like a title caliber coach, a winning the SEC playoff caliber coach?
This he would have left North Carolina for one of those jobs anyway.
But he would have given that to North Carolina for at least 3 to 5 years first. I believe that, because they could have won legitimately and finally. 10 years of doing that coach gossip thing, and everyone goes, well, they got the Jordan brand, they're a sleeping giant, They could have, man. They could have.
Well, and that's the thing. They weren't bad under Mac Brown.
No. They demanded greatness.
And the roster wasn't bad under Mac Brown.
No, they demanded greatness. They weren't bad under Larry Fedora. They weren't bad. The demand was greatness.
Yeah.
And this is what you got. You got greatness. Live with it. Mm.
While we're on the subject of greatness, we need to talk about one more thing with the ACC.
Oh, God.
Tiebreakers.
Oh, tiebreakers. Yeah.
So,
yeah,
this
I
is
was
the
there.
That brought
so,
you a
please explain that to me.
Champ last year because Duke was 7-5 going into the conference championship game. Virginia had the best record in the conference. They were the only 7-1 team in the conference. They were in. You had a 5-way tie at 6-2 that Duke won because it had the highest aggregate opponent conference winning percentage. So ostensibly the toughest conference schedule. They decided after this happened, because Duke wins the ACC title, does not make the playoff. Miami barely gets into the playoff and then obviously goes to the national title game. They decided, got to fix the tiebreakers so that the actual best teams play for the conference title. In the process of this, they also decide to go to 9 games because that's what the SEC is doing. The SEC is going to 9 conference games, and the ACC typically follows everything the SEC does, and so they're going to go to 9 conference games. Here's the problem when you have a 17-team league, though. Mathematically, not everyone can play 9 conference games. And then when you spring it on everybody as close to the deadline as you did, not everybody can adjust their schedule. So here's what's going to happen. 12 teams are going to play 9 conference games this year. 5 teams are going to play 8 conference games this year. That creates a sticky wicket when it comes to tiebreakers to figure out who plays for the conference title. And so they came up with a system where they don't want to disadvantage the teams that play different numbers of conference games. So you can have an 8-1 conference team that is essentially tied with a 7-1 team. And how do you break that tie? Mm. Or how about this one? This is a quandary that a reader sent me, and this is why I reached out to the ACC to get the explanation for this. If an 8-1 team is tied with a 7-1 team, and a 7-1 team is tied with a 7-2 team, because you're tied if either of your, whether your win or loss column matches your tie.
I haven't struck.
Then is an 8-1 team tied with a 7-2 team? And so Michael Strickland, the senior VP of football for the ACC, nice enough to take me through this. So here's how it works. We'll use the scenario like last year where let's say there's a really good team. They go 9-0 in conference play. They are in the conference championship game and you've got one more spot and then you have a 3-way tie or you have 3 teams in contention for that spot. One of them went 7-1 in conference play. One of them went 8-1 in conference play and one of them went 7-2 in conference play. So here's how that will work. They will take the 8-1 team, because that's the best winning percentage of the bunch, and they'll set them here. And then they will say, okay, who do we compare to them? The team we'll compare to them is the 7-1 team, because we don't have another way to compare them because their winning percentages won't match. They didn't play the same number of conference games.
Okay.
So you have the 8-1 team and the 7-1 team. If they played head-to-head, the head-to-head winner wins that tiebreak. If they didn't, they go to the Sports Source Analytics team success ranking, which is kind of similar to all those, you know, Sagarin and the different rating services that helped make up the BCS formula back in the day. So kind of a predictive, takes everything into account. SP Plus, our friend Bill Connolly, he does one like that. The FPI is like that. So that would do it. Now, that actually has been a part of the ACC's tiebreaker formula for years. They just never got that low.
Okay.
Okay, so that now you're wondering, okay, what about 7-2 team?
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if I've had a stroke in this segment.
Yeah.
I'm so lost. But, yeah. It's probably easier if you read this, but I'm going to keep explaining. Yeah. So, all right.
My head hurts.
So, there's two things. Let's say they didn't play head to head, but the 8-1 team is higher in the sports source ranking. So the 8-1 team goes. If it's an 8-1 team versus a 7-2 team at this point, well, now they've played an even number of conference games. They're not tied. The 8-1 team gets the spot. If the 7-1 team prevails, when compared to the 8-1 team, then it's the same thing again. With the 7-1 and the 7-2, did they play each other? If they did, the head-to-head winner goes. If they didn't, it's the sports source ranking. So it's actually not as complicated as you'd probably think. Because
apparently it's never easy.
All the more complicated ones, according to Michael Strickland, all the more complicated versions of this created an endless loop that could go forever.
Oh, the ACC is going to destroy the world. Nice. Okay. Yes. All right. Yeah.
A singularity. So.
Yeah, this is what they were worried about in the second act of Oppenheimer, but the ACC Football League actually did it. Not a fission.
Figured it out. Yeah.
Beautiful. Beautiful. Yeah. Beautiful. How about you don't have the Bay Area teams in your conference and you make divisions? And you do this like we've done it for 100 years.
Mm-hmm. We're all going to regret getting rid of divisions. Everybody's going to regret getting rid of divisions. It was great. It was fun.
It was stupid.
It was fun because every year you could figure out
less
all
stupid.
Seven teams go 4-4 in conference play.
I would say, significantly less stupid than this.
What's going to happen? When they expand the playoff and they get rid of conference championship games, and then you have to have a tiebreaker for who won the regular season championship. Like, I think everybody's going to regret getting rid of the divisions and expanding to an absurd number of schools in a conference.
Oh, they already regret it, but it's too late now, Ross.
You can do one, you can't do both.
It is.
The horse is out of the barn.
Yeah. It's the ACC is the dumbest by far in this scenario. So I like that they probably think they've solved last year's problem.
I don't think they feel that way. I think they realize that having a 17 team league creates
stupid
all manner of problems. And then also deciding at the drop of a hat to go to 9 conference games in a sport where they schedule 15 years in advance was going to cause more problems. So they knew.
Yeah.
They get it. It's we pile on the ACC, but they understand they've created
because we
mess.
Should because it's real stupid. Yeah. This is bad. This is dumb. It's a bad product. It's bad for consumers.
Ross,
it's literally bad for everyone.
When the conference championships games go away and you're only just trying to figure out who the champion is. Can we go back to the Big 12? Their motto was one true champion, and they handed out 2 championship trophies that year. Like, let's do it.
Yeah,
everybody gets a trophy.
Yep.
Such a wonderful, stupid sport, but wonderful, but stupid.
We love it. And we'll talk more about this wonderful, wonderful, stupid, wonderful, but also very wonderful and very stupid sport when we talk to you on Tuesday.